watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Unwelcome guests, I'm Lynn Gary. In the underground history of education that I've been reading from over the past few months, author John Taylor Gatto has relentlessly proved that the system of compulsory schooling was set up in America with the backing of industrial barons in order to reconfigure society, to create a proletariat to work in its factories, and a pool of consumers dependent on its products. Standing in the way of this progress were the family farms, which used to comprise more than 80% of the population. The process we now call globalization is reenacting this transformation in the global South, destroying subsistence farming communities and driving the people into vast urban slums where their desperation may be profitably exploited as a low-wage workforce. In last week's reading, Gatto explained how increased school taxes were used to drive out the farmers who used to surround and supply the cities, and how the real estate industry made a land grab under the guise of quality education. The real object was not to provide a quality education, but to wage economic warfare. What, Gatto asked, does a football stadium with lights and fancy band uniforms have to do with a quality education? Nothing. By tripling and tripling again school taxes over the past half century, as well as by forcing children into all-day schools until their late teens, the infrastructure of family farms was undermined from all sides. The farmers gave up and sold out, and their land was transformed by real estate developers into the soulless society of suburban sprawl with which we're now saddled. Populated by rootless and isolated people, completely dependent on the corporate economy for all their needs. The government has been an active partner in this process of social transformation because it has long been dominated by corporate interests and their political and economic objectives. Last week, Gatto explained that as far back as the Teddy Roosevelt administration, policymakers had decided that they wanted food production to be centralized and helped through farm policy to create agribusiness that now foists its lousy, poisonous food and toxic leavings upon us. Why do family farmers pose such a threat? The traditional family farm was able to meet the basic needs of survival: food, water, shelter, and energy. Farmers were less tied to the cash economy than urban industrial workers. If you have food and shelter, you're in a better position to resist something you don't like. You may have to tighten your belt, but you can live and fight on. From a tactical standpoint, because the production of basic necessities is distributed, a few choke points can't be easily employed to starve a population into submission. The corporate assault on rural America continues. People in rural America have been fighting back, and thanks to a movement that has grown up in central Pennsylvania, they're fighting back in a way that goes to the basic question of power. This model of organized resistance is being taught by what are called democracy schools, and they're taking that fight beyond the Pennsylvania state line. It all began when a group of young law school graduates set up a public interest environmental law firm in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, to help the rural poor fight the poisoning of their communities. This has evolved over time into something much more fundamental, a challenge to the system of American law that puts property over people. Last week, one of the founders of Democracy Schools, Tom Lindsay, of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, spoke in Montour Falls, New York, about the latest from the front lines of that battle. For local listeners who missed him, don't worry. You're going to hear it on the program this week. And we'll follow that with the next installment from the underground history of American education. If you're a regular listener to the show, some of this information will be familiar, as we've covered this movement on several occasions. But stay tuned, because there are new developments. As the conservative rural communities who began by opposing factory farms and other toxic incursions have evolved through the struggle into escalating challenges to the authority of the state and the rights it has bestowed upon corporations. Here's Tom Lindsay.
I'm going to talk for a little while. Usually when we have smaller groups, we try like to talk with you rather than at you. But there's some stuff happening in Pennsylvania, and we're making the rounds of New York State, apparently. We were in Stafford, New York, over the weekend, teaching one of our three-day intensive training sessions for community leaders and activists and municipal lawyers and officials. And then this afternoon, we were in Auburn at the Holiday Inn with a group of folks who were concerned about a bunch of different issues, including water quality and factory farms and a bunch of different things along those lines. Just to start... Where our organization began, to give a one-minute synopsis of who we are and where we come from. I work for an organization called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We're a nonprofit law firm that was formed back in 1995 to do something that appeared to us at that point to be fairly simple, which was to provide free legal services to community organizations and rural municipal elected governments. What seemed to be so simple turned into something very complicated. The free legal services part was because, as anybody knows who's gone to try to find a lawyer to do work on behalf of a municipal government or a community group, knows that at this point in time it costs between $200 and $600 an hour just to retain a lawyer to work on an ordinance or sit down with them and discuss a particular issue or talk about a particular policy. And it still floors me, the statistic, but it's the same today as it was over a decade ago, which is that today in the United States, we only have 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers. That's in the United States, only 200. And so coming out of law school, we figured that we would add a couple to that number because the problem must be, because things are getting worse outside in terms of environmental issues and degradation and environmental destruction, loss of community control and rural quality of life and all those types of things, that the problem certainly couldn't be our vaunted environmental laws, right? Because going through law school, they teach you that the United States has the best environmental laws in the world. In fact, our environmental laws are so good that we export our lawyers out to other countries to help them replicate our environmental laws in those countries. So certainly the problem can't be our environmental laws. The problem is that there simply aren't enough people enforcing those laws. And so we sought to add a couple more to the roles to represent community organizations in these local governments. Now, as you can imagine, when you hang out your shingle and your shingle says free legal services, the line runs around the block. You know, it's like ticket sales, you know, people camping out to get the legal services. And eventually, at one point in Pennsylvania, we were assisting 300 client organizations. In other words, 300 community organizations, about 200 rural local governments across the state of Pennsylvania. We were retained by them to deal with certain situations that had arisen in their communities. For example, our client community groups might come from a community that was facing a toxic waste incinerator. So plans for a toxic waste incinerator are being made to drive one of those incinerators into the community. A 5,000-head hog factory farm, for example, might want a site in the middle of the community, and the community didn't want it. They were gearing up for a battle. Could be a landfill, could be sewage sludge being spread on land, which has become a big issue in Pennsylvania that we're going to be talking about in a couple minutes. Could be any single issue of the hundreds of single issues that have attacked rural Pennsylvania over the past 30 years, that community groups were coming to us for help in battling. And just a note on Pennsylvania, we have a lot in common with rural New York in certain parts of Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, we have an area of land within central Pennsylvania called the Rural T, which is south central, north central Pennsylvania. It's where everything gets dumped. Okay? So sewage sludge, for example, doesn't get dumped outside of Philadelphia with the suburban million-dollar homes. It doesn't go there. It goes into the very rural areas of Pennsylvania that can't fight back generally. These are the rural, poor, no land use ordinances, no other ordinances existing in those communities. So everything from low-level radioactive waste dumps to toxic waste incinerators, to landfills, to land-applied sewage sludge, to corporate factory farms, all of those folks and all of those entities generally end up in central Pennsylvania. These groups that were coming to us, it's very important to be clear that the groups that were coming to us and the rural local governments that were coming to us for help would not call us up and say, we want your help to better regulate the toxic waste incinerator that wants to come into our community. In other words, they didn't call us up asking us to help tweak the regulation somehow to make the operation cause a little less harm within the community. After all, when communities rise up, they're rising up to say, no, we don't want it, period. So they weren't saying, help us tweak it a little bit better so that it doesn't cause as much environmental harm. They were saying, we don't want it. Because our vision of a sustainable community here in this community does not include a toxic waste incinerator in the middle of it. Doesn't include a 10,000-head hog factory farm in the middle of it. Doesn't include a landfill that we don't want, right, within our community. And so they would say to us, we want your help to stop this from coming in. And that's generally the message that would come across from the community groups and local governments. To which we had to explain to these folks patiently a very hard fact that exists in the United States today, which is this. If the state government has deemed the use, in other words, the project, the incinerator, the landfill, whatever, as a legal use under the law, L-E-G-A-L, a legal use, and that the state has permitted that use, issue a permit for the factory farm or the toxic waste incinerator or landfill, all of which are legal uses, that the municipality, the local community, is prohibited from banning it. Okay? Prohibited from banning it. Now, I'm not here tonight to open up Pandora's box of legal secrets. That's just well understood, black letter, well settled law in this country. You can talk to the corporate lawyers, talk to the environmental lawyers, talk to any lawyers who have experience in municipal law. That's just the way it is. It's the way it functions. So when these groups came to us and said, we want you to help us stop these facilities, we would look back at them and say, we'd love to, but we can't, because you can't stop it from coming in. You can't ban the use from coming into your community. We would say to them, but what we can do for you, instead of working to ban it, which is something you can't do under the law, is we'll appeal that permit that's been issued by the state. So in Pennsylvania, we have the Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP. People make the mistake of thinking that because the DEP has the words environmental protection in it, that it has anything to do with environmental protection. We call the DEP in Pennsylvania the Department of Everything Permitted, because in essence, that's what the state agency does. It almost serves the role of legalizing certain harms to come into the community. That's what the permits do. And so we would say to the community organization, we can't help you stop it, but what we can do is appeal this permit that's been issued for it, right? And the community group, which would have no other option because they've been explained by the authority figure, which is the lawyer coming in, that they don't have the legal authority to stop it under the law, would retain us to fight the permit that had been issued by the state, to try to overturn it. The permit that had been issued by the DEP. And so as anybody that's been involved in regulatory agencies and begging and pleading these folks to do the right thing for the community knows that in some deep, dark, dank basement, actually it's probably not top floor well lit, but just for story purposes, we use the basement, you have a reviewer sitting within the DEP at the state regulatory agency level who in one hand has the permit application that's been put in by the corporation that's driving the facility into the community. And in the other hand, the reviewer has the environmental regulations, which say that when you submit a permit application, it has to have X, Y, Z, A, B, and C in it. In other words, all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed. Reviewer compares the environmental regulations and the permit application. And if the permit application is administratively complete, that's legal language for saying that all the boxes are filled in, you know, all the materials have been produced and all the boxes are filled in, then the permit issues. That's how the state regulatory agencies work. Compare the regs against the permit application. If it's complete, then the permit issued. Our job was to go in and find things wrong with the permit application that was submitted. So, for example, if the environmental regulations required a $25,000 bond to be posted for the highway or the road that was going to be used for the incinerator or the landfill or whatever, and the permit application that was put in only had a $10,000 bond with it, that we would go in front of the judge and we would argue, Your Honor, under section little 2, little 3, little C, little D, little I, little E, little Roman numeral 2, little I, little E of the regulations, the permit was issued when it shouldn't have been because it didn't include the $25,000 bond in it, right? Or the erosion and sedimentation control plan. Or the president didn't sign it, but the secretary of the corporation did, and that's not allowed under the regulations under 2, little D, little 3, little E, little I. So we would go in and make those arguments. And 90% of the time, not because we were the silver-tongued guys going in, but mostly because most community groups never have any representation at all because they can't afford it, right? So we were walking in, and at least we were there, that 90% of the time, the judge would say, you're absolutely right. Under little 2, little D, little 3, little I, little E, little 2, little I, needed a $25,000 bond. They didn't have it, wasn't posted with it. And so I'm going to overturn the permit. And we would win. Judge throws out the permit. We then engage in something that I look back on as a Groundhog Day. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray in it. For folks that haven't seen it, Bill Murray in the movie, he relives the same day over and over and over and over again. And he lives his life trying to break out of living that same day. Our Groundhog Day occurred with each one of those citizens' organizations. Because after we got the permit thrown out, the next thing that would happen is we'd be invited to a victory party back at the house of the community organizers that had retained us in the first place to appeal the permit, challenge the permit. We'd have a victory party, we'd drink some beer, we'd have some snacks, and everybody within the community group would pat each other on the back, and they'd say, the system works, right? We got together around a kitchen table, which is where I think the only place democracy exists today, actually in the United States, is around kitchen tables of neighbors coming together to figure out how to solve problems. They said, we came together, we exercised our First Amendment rights and our right to petition, right to assemble, and all those things that are supposed to be guaranteed to us by the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. We picked up the phone, we called a lawyer. Lawyer came in. He was a good guy. We think he was a good guy. We found a reasonable judge. We made the argument. The judge overturned the permit, and now we've won. Because the permit's been tossed. What would happen 30, 60, 90 days after? The corporation would come back. And they'd file a new permit application. And because of our efforts, the permit application was new and improved. Because we had identified all the gaps and omissions and niches within the permit application process, the structure itself, right? And so the new application that came back in was bulletproof. Because we did our work so well that we identified all the deficiencies within a permit application. The corporation just came in and filled them in. They said $25,000 bond? Yep, we have that now. Right? Signed by the secretary rather than the president? We fixed that too. Erosion and sedimentation control plan? Yep, we hired a consultant, filled it out, attached it to the permit application. Right? The citizen group would come back to us and they would say, Mr. Lindsay, we need you to do that jujitsu that you did the first time around to get the judge to throw the permit application out. And we'd look back at them and we'd say, we're sorry, there's nothing we can do because we have no levers anymore to exercise on your behalf. Permit application now bulletproof. In essence, we were doing the work of the corporations for them by building better permit applications. Right? Someone much smarter than me back in the mid-1990s when all this was going on came up with a phrase, and I know she was a lot smarter than me because it still echoes in my head, which is, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is environmentalists. Because they make our activism predictable. The folks that wrote the regulations are usually the corporations which are the subject of those regulations in the first place. And those corporations write a script for us, and we follow it. Our activism follows it. Okay? And another point that I was not aware of, which was, at least I thought that we were costing the corporations money. you know, appealing a permit, the corporation would have to come in and hire lawyers and fight it out with us in the Environmental Permit Regulatory Appeal Forum, the courts. We thought we were costing them money. At least we were doing something. Well, then we found out that all the money that the corporation spends in terms of beating back nuisance little citizen community organizations is tax deductible under the law.
That's right.
It's a reasonable and necessary business expense under the law. So it's tax deductible. What would happen after the community group came to us and asked us to represent them again? And we said, we're sorry, there's nothing we can do because there's no levers left in the environmental regulations to use. 30, 60, 90, 120, 140 days later, what they would get is a brand new toxic waste incinerator in the middle of their community, or a brand new factory farm, right? Or 10,000 tons of sludge coming in from New York City to be dumped in rural Pennsylvania. On paper, we looked great. 174 wins, 3 losses. Pretty impressive. We got the funding, we got the awards, we got invited to the White House one year with other environmental law firms for a visit. In short, on paper, we looked wonderful. But when you peered under the paper and looked into the communities, they were getting shellacked. Because what was on paper bore absolutely no resemblance to what was happening on the ground. It was at that point that we decided to close the Legal Defense Fund. We actually started moving the furniture out, making arrangements to shut down the phones. All kinds of those things started happening within our office. It was at that point the phone started ringing off the hook. And the phone started ringing off the hook with some constituency that we were not prepared to assist, which was rural municipal governments in south central, north central parts of Pennsylvania. Wasn't 5 local governments, wasn't 10, wasn't 20, wasn't 50. It was 300 local governments calling us for help. So the question is, why would 300 local governments be calling us, who were quite small? We're still quite small. You know, back then, we could fit in the closet of an office, pretty much. That they were calling us for help because something had happened in the state of Pennsylvania. And what happened was Hatfield Foods and Smithfield Foods Corporation, 2 of the 4 agribusiness corporations that control 70% of pork production in the United States. We have 4 corporations in the United States that control 70% of pork production in this country. It's no different than other livestock production, chicken production. 5 corporations control 70% of chicken production in the United States. 1 corporation controls 70% of cheese production. It's Kraft. 70% of cheese production in the United States. We have lost 300,000 farmers over the past 20 years in the United States. 300,000 farmers. We always use the passive verb, lost, like, you know, we can't find them. We don't know where they went. Well, they've been eliminated because they could not compete in a corporatized agricultural system. In Pennsylvania, we've eliminated 1,500 once independent livestock family farmers over the past 15 years in the state of Pennsylvania. Suicide among farmers, now the number one cause of death, surpassing equipment-related deaths for farmers back in 2002. Okay? 59 cents of every food dollar goes to the 4 largest agribusiness corporations. What we have is not a factory farm problem. What we have is a corporatization of agriculture problem. That a very small number of corporations has rapidly replaced what was once a family farm production system in the United States. You have a handful of people now deciding what you will eat in the food production cycle. The reason why these municipal governments were calling us was because Smithfield Foods Corporation and Hatfield Foods Corporation were being chased out of North Carolina and South Carolina, where they had caused huge problems with these large cesspools from these factory farm operations that have been built across the states, North Carolina and South Carolina. The legislatures in those states, after a hurricane came through and uncapped all the cesspools and then sent it into the ocean, creating a dead zone off the coast, decided to find a new state to screw up. And that new state was Pennsylvania. But they had a problem. And the problem was that in the state of Pennsylvania, in this rural area that we call the Rural T, there were 400 municipal governments that had local ordinances on the books that very stringently controlled the way that liquid manure could be disposed of within those communities. Very important point. 400 local governments had passed ordinances as a way to stop factory farms from coming into those municipalities. by very stringently regulating the land application of liquid manure from facilities that would otherwise set up shop in those municipalities. The agribusiness corporations, when they came in, did what corporations do, which is they went to the legislature. They drafted a bill, and they got the bill introduced into the legislature through the House and Senate Ag Committees, which in Pennsylvania are bought, sold, and traded by the agribusiness corporations in the state. And that bill was titled with the funny little subject title of the Nutrient Management Act. The state law, Nutrient Management Act, which was a planning law. If you're going to build a new 5,000-head hog factory farm, you needed to submit a plan to the state to say how you were going to deal with your manure. There's no enforcement provisions. There were no fines. There was nobody authorized to issue fines, leaving aside the fact that most of those regulatory ordinances were about us running around in a hamster wheel anyway. The Nutrient Management Act at 2 o'clock in the morning as it was going through the legislature. I don't know about New York, but in Pennsylvania, the legislature does their best work at 2 o'clock in the morning. They shoved the provision in that preempted all 400 local ordinances in central Pennsylvania from being enforced. All 400 local ordinances in one swoop through the Nutrient Management Act were preempted and nullified, and a prohibition on any new townships, any new municipal governments, passing ordinances of similar nature dealing with manure disposal. What happened next was given the green light. Hatfield Foods Corporation, Smithfield Foods Corporation, ran into central Pennsylvania, started setting up 5,000, 10,000 head hog factory farms as quickly as they possibly could. Put yourself in the position of a municipal elected official in one of these communities that's passed a local ordinance. You have the citizens on one side of you screaming at you to do something to stop the factory farms from coming in. If you live within a quarter of a mile of one of these factory farm facilities, you lose 40% of your property value overnight. Happens in the state of Pennsylvania, not to mention the well pollution, odor pollution, water pollution, all the other things that flow from these facilities. On the other side, you have your lawyer for the municipality. And the lawyer is telling you that there's nothing you can do because the Nutrient Management Act was passed. It's the state. State preempts you. That's the way our system works. Federal government preempts the state. State preempts the local governments, right? Some people are happy with that. And so the local solicitor said, we're sorry, there's nothing you can do. Nothing you can pass, nothing you can enforce. You can't do anything. You just got to lay back and let these factory farm facilities come in. Well, some folks weren't too happy with that. Our phone ringing off the hook was an indicator that some folks weren't too happy with that. And one of the things we could have done at that point for these local governments was to say, we'll come in and appeal those nutrient management plans that have been approved under the Nutrient Management Act. Thus, continuing this process of doing work within the regulatory arena under rules that were written by somebody else to do our work under. Instead, we turned our back on the regulatory system, and we began looking at other communities that were dealing with this corporatization of agriculture issue. And sure enough, in Pennsylvania, our factory farms are 5,000 to 10,000 hogs big. Those are boutique factory farms compared to what they have in the Midwest. Midwest, they don't screw around with 10,000 head hog factory farms. They have 250,000 head hog factory farms and 700,000 head hog factory farms, stretching off into the distance, aluminum cladded football field size long buildings stretching off in the distance in these plains in the Midwest. In addition to the hogs, they have 10 million chicken broiler operations operating now. Pennsylvania, we're getting a 3 million chicken broiler operation soon. Dairy operations, no need to tell folks in this room about dairy in New York. We now have 7,000 to 10,000 head dairy operations, essentially confined dairy operations operating. The big dairy boys have plans. They have a big plan for four large spokes of dairy operations across the United States, which will eventually house several million dairy animals in those four spokes, and put the rest of the family dairy industry out of business. That's the plan. They're not secret about it. I mean, it's laid out on paper, and Department of Ag participate in the plan because it's their way of securing a safe and healthy milk production system, and an efficient one, to get rid of these family farmers. Nothing personal. Family farmers just happen to be very inefficient. So we need to set up a different kind of production. In Pennsylvania, we began researching how folks in the Midwest had dealt with this situation. Because surely we felt that community groups and farmers and environmental organizations probably confronted this somehow differently than all the folks scurrying around like the Sierra Club and ED Environmental Defense Fund, all these environmental groups who treat the factory farm issue as just an environmental issue. It's not just an environmental issue. It's a social issue. It's a cultural issue. It's an economic issue. We are wiping out rural Pennsylvania and rural New York and family farmers that have been the linchpin of those economies over the past 100, 150, 200 years. That's what's happening, turning control over to a small handful of agribusiness corporations. When we looked in the Midwest, we found something surprising, which was that some folks in the Midwest seemed to understand that this was not about water pollution or odor pollution or environmental harms flowing from these things, but was about something much more basic, which was about turning control over to a small handful of people ensconced within these agribusiness corporations to make decisions about what food production looked like, and then trumping decisions made by local communities who want the food production system to look different and be sustainable. In the Midwest, they didn't screw around with odor pollution laws or water pollution laws or those types of things. Instead, they passed new laws that were corporate-focused. What did these new laws do? They banned agribusiness corporations from farming. Okay? I'll say it again. These Midwestern states understood that the problem was much more basic than trying to do end-of-the-pipe solutions by trying to control odor pollution or water pollution from these facilities. Instead, they framed the problem differently, which was, we think the problem is the corporatization of agriculture. And the answer, if the problem is the corporatization of agriculture, is to get corporations out of agriculture. And so they passed laws that ban agribusiness corporations from engaging in farming. Okay? 9 states, starting in 1904 in places like Oklahoma, running up until the late 1990s in places like Nebraska and South Dakota. South Dakota Amendment E, Nebraska Initiative 300. Unhappy with just driving them in as statutes in South Dakota and Nebraska, they made them part of the state constitutions. They drove them into the state constitutions, these bans on agribusiness corporations engaging in farming. We like what we saw, so we stole the South Dakota model. We went in, we cut and pasted Amendment E from South Dakota. We brought it into Pennsylvania as a local ordinance that not only bans agribusiness corporations from engaging in farming, but also, just to be a pain in the ass, we put a citizen supervision into the law, which said the local government wouldn't enforce the law, that citizens could step in and enforce the law themselves. That ordinance has been passed by 12 municipalities and 5 counties in Pennsylvania. Immediately following the passage of those ordinances, actually during the passage of the last couple of them, our phone rang off the hook with a different kind of constituency, worried about a different issue, and this time the issue was land-applied sewage sludge. Folks probably in this room know a lot about land-applied sewage sludge, but just to cover some of the basics, sludge is everything that goes down the toilet or down the sink in an area that's hooked up to a centralized sewage treatment plant. Sewage treatment plants in urban areas also bring in industrial and commercial sludge. In other words, the waste stream from industrial and commercial plants, which can include things like chemotherapeutic waste from hospitals, metals from industrial commercial plants, anything that's dumped down the waste stream in urbanized areas. What's in the sludge can contain up to 300,000 different toxic contaminants in the waste stream. How many do the regulatory agencies require testing for? 11. Most of the agribusiness advocates like to talk about sludge as nutrient or fertilizer. It is a toxic soup, which is now applied to land. We used to not apply it to land. We used to dump it in the ocean off the coast of New Jersey. That's how we dealt with sludge. We would truck it off to New Jersey and dump it off the coast. What happened next? You don't have to be a brain surgeon to understand what happens when you dump crap and toxics into the ocean, created a dead zone the size of Rhode Island off the coast of New Jersey. So the environmental groups got together with the folks that originally come up with ocean disposal of sludge as an option for disposing of sludge, and they came up with something new. And what they came up with new was something called the 503 regulations under the Environmental Protection Agency. The 503 regulations now allow sludge, and 60% of all sludge produced in the United States is now treated this way, to be land applied to land where we grow our crops, both for ourselves as well as for livestock 60% of all sewage sludge being produced by the sewage treatment plants is now applied to land. Who makes the money? Five corporations control 70% of sludge hauling in the United States. The money comes from municipal authorities and sewage plants operated under other arrangements within the municipality. Municipalities generally have an option, or cities, when they're dealing with sewage sludge, which is to stuff it in a landfill, which costs X dollars, or pay one of your handy-dandy waste management corporations to come in and pick it up from your municipal authority for Y dollars. Y dollars is usually cheaper than X dollars, and so most of it ends up going onto a truck and being trucked on the back end to farmers, where it's sold as free fertilizer for the farmers. Farmers aren't stupid, at least in our neck of the woods, right? And the farmers look back at the Waste Management Corporation or the Synagro Corporation or the Enviro Corporation or the Hydropress Corporation, and they say to them, if this stuff is so good, why are you giving it to us for free? Right? This stuff is so great, why are you giving it to us for free? And the corporations are so lucky because they reach in their back pocket and they pull out a brochure that's put together by the state, Department of Environmental Protection, our DEP, that says how great biosolids recycling is. Because I'm happy to report in Pennsylvania, at least, we don't have sewage sludge anymore. We have biosolids. And the biosolids aren't being land applied. They're being recycled. So we have biosolids recycling. I'm also proud to report that we don't have factory farms anymore in the state of Pennsylvania. We have advanced and modern farming. The product of the public relations firm that was hired with taxpayer money to make these terms warmer and fuzzier for the public. Right? So what happened next? Well, these sludge communities, the folks that were getting the sludge, called us up because they had been following the anti-corporate farming laws. They said, could you use this model for the sludge and put together some anti-corporate sludging laws that instead of regulating the activity, would go after the corporations that are actually doing the activity within the community? We said, sure. We drafted the ordinance. We sent it out. First five communities passed it, then 10, then 20, then 30. We're up to 78 municipalities in Pennsylvania in 9 counties, which now ban corporations from spreading sludge within the municipality. So all told in Pennsylvania, about 100 municipalities across the state out of 900 rural Pennsylvania municipalities, about 10%, have passed our new ordinance frameworks that switch the organizing away from the regulatory script under which we've been operating for 40 years and instead switch it to something that is focused on the fundamental stuff about who is going to make waste management decisions in a community and who is going to make food production decisions within a community. Is it going to be a majority of people within the community, or is it going to be a small handful of people ensconced in the largest agribusiness and sludge corporations that operate on the planet? Question.
Tom, who defines what an agribusiness corporation is?
You mean under the laws?
No, under these regulations that you have.
Under the ordinances.
Right.
Yes. The general language is it bans corporations from engaging in farming, and then it exempts out family farm corporations as not being subject to the law.
So you have that clearly defined, the difference between the two?
Yes, it's in the ordinance, built into the ordinance, because they want it to very scalpily take out and exempt family farmers who incorporate for tax or trust purposes out from underneath the coverage of the ban that's contained within the ordinance. That was a very important piece of both the Midwestern laws as well as the ordinances in the states. Yes?
Let's just stop Pennsylvania's legislature from just doing away with all these ordinances.
Excellent question. Excellent segue. Which is what happened next. Because for every action, as we know, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And in fact, when you're dealing with some of the largest agribusiness and sludge corporations on the planet, the reaction is apt not to be equal, but to be quite unequal. What the agribusiness boys did was they began drafting new bills, and they gave them to their Senate and House sponsors. And these bills were interesting bills because if the folks on the ground in these Pennsylvania townships had done the same regulatory work that they had done for years and for decades, the legislature very easily preempts those. Now, let's say a municipality says we're only going to allow 5 parts per million of benzene to be dumped into a river. And the legislature comes in and says, no, 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 5 parts is too low. We're going to allow 15 parts of benzene. They put the law through and they preempt the municipality. And nobody pays a whit of attention. Because nobody's following 5 parts, 7 parts, 9 parts. Nobody gives a crap, to tell you the truth. in the Pennsylvania, in the community organizations and environmental groups in Pennsylvania that are trying to follow this stuff. What happened with these pieces of legislation was that the legislature could not preempt them the same way that they usually do, because they weren't regulatory ordinances. They were something much more fundamental, which meant the legislature had to begin drafting laws, drafting bills, or taking ones drafted by the agribusiness boys that stripped townships of ordinance-making power. Okay? Started with a little bill called Senate Bill 826. Senate Bill 826 pops up in the legislature, goes into the Senate, passes the Senate 48-2. The bill stripping communities of ordinance-making authority. Comes into the House of Representatives. We start getting phone calls from different groups across the state, some which were not normal for us to receive. For example, picked up the phone one day, it's the United Mine Workers of America, the UMWA. They said, we've heard about the Senate Bill 826. I said, why do you guys care about Senate Bill 826? They said, well, our workers have been getting sick from land-applied sewage sludge, which is being used to reclaim old mine sites across the state. Right? He said, your ordinances are the only things keeping sludge from being spread in some of the areas where we have workers working, so they're not getting sick. And he said, the UMWA guy said, we want to join your coalition. To which I said, what coalition? Right? Because we didn't have a coalition to fight anything, it was just us. UMWA came on board, Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture came on board, Pennsylvania Farmers Union came on board, 400 municipal governments came forward to beat Senate Bill 826. Senate Bill 826, we defeated. Now, as everybody knows, the legislature, when they're faced with a defeat of an unpopular bill, they simply go home and they don't reintroduce anything, right? Well, of course not. Next time around, which was the next year, they renumbered and reintroduced Senate Bill 826 as Senate Bill 1413. The numbers don't matter. But this one included an attorney's fees provision, which said if a municipality enforced an ordinance that was frivolous under the law, that the municipality would have to pay attorney's fees to the corporation that brought a challenge to the ordinance in the first place. Senate Bill 1413 passed the Senate 48-2, goes into the House of Representatives. Our coalition reorganizes, and we beat back Senate Bill 1413. Goes down in flames. For 5 years, this coalition, kind of cranky, because you got Sierra Club on one side, UMWA, they haven't been in the same room in 40 years, let alone the same planet, right? That this cranky coalition defeated the most powerful agribusiness and sludge corporations in the state of Pennsylvania, sent little tremors through the political establishment in Harrisburg in the Capitol. For 5 years, this coalition organized, and for 5 years, this coalition beat back that legislation. Until one day, a little man named Edward Rendell was elected to become governor in the state of Pennsylvania. Eddie, who we now call Fast Eddie, was mayor of Philadelphia, a liberal Democrat, and the environmental groups came to us and said, shoo, we've been fighting this for 5 years. Now we have a liberal Democrat in office. And Eddie Rendell, he's never going to sell municipalities down the river. He's never going to strip local control. Right? So the coalition said, well, for 5 years we've been doing a lot of work and we need to take some time off. And so we kind of loosened the coalition a little bit. Next thing you know, good old Eddie Rendell is introducing a bill that strips municipalities of ordinance-making authority by establishing a 5-member board of state political appointees empowered as judges to overturn ordinances passed by democratically elected local officials. And that, my friends, is the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to corporate control, which is bupkis. Bupkis, right? In fact, good old Eddie Rendell did an even better job in getting the legislation through because he had the votes. Up until that time, we had built a coalition of Republicans who were local control folks and Democrats who cared about all the bad things that happened from sludge and factory farms. And we put them together, and they were a coalition that stopped legislation from moving through the House of Representatives. Eddie Rendell's bill had full support from the Democrats. We can only peel a couple of the Republican local control guys away. Our coalition drove back into the legislature, and we got the 5-member board stripped out of the bill. It was replaced with the Attorney General's office, authorizing and empowering the Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania to sue municipal governments in the state to overturn ordinances passed by those municipal governments to control agribusiness and sludge corporations operating within those municipalities. 6 weeks ago, the Attorney General's office filed their first 8 lawsuits against municipal governments. 6 weeks ago. In essence, what's happened in Pennsylvania now is that the agribusiness sludge corporations only need to pick up the phone. They call the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General provides a free lawyer to them to go in to threaten the municipality that if they don't repeal their ordinance, that they will be sued by the state. Right? Sued by the state. Something interesting happened 3 weeks ago, which was the Attorney General sent one of his assistants into a garage in a small rural township in a place called Schuylkill County, East Brunswick Township, to threaten the municipal officials that if they didn't overturn their sludge ordinance, that the municipality would be sued by the state. About 150 people turned out in the garage that night, and they were not going to allow the Assistant Attorney General to do what he had come to do, and they physically removed him from the meeting in the garage. Okay? It's the kind of stuff that's starting to happen in Pennsylvania. And in essence, what it is a revolt. It's a revolt against an existing structure of law that's been carefully built brick by brick over the past 130 years by the corporate boys to strip you of any sovereign governing authority whatsoever within your communities. That's what it is.
Has anyone been so crafty as to try some other type of local ordinance to test the waters and see if the Attorney General's office is so quick to react?
Of course. AG's office is, I mean, we constantly have ordinances in transit and being passed. This one.
Something other than agribusiness,
sludge,
or whatever. Are they strictly looking at that particular type of ordinance?
The law that was passed under Rendell was called ACRE. House Bill 1646, and ACRE just dealt with agricultural ordinances. But your question is an excellent one because we've now expanded. We don't just do sludge and agribusiness ordinances. We've now moved into mining. We have an anti-corporate mining ordinance that was passed in western Pennsylvania about 4 months ago. We now have anti-corporate land development ordinances. And over the past 6 months, we've dumped the anti-corporate stuff pretty much, and we've moved into much different kinds of ordinances that, in essence, establish a proactive vision of what people want in the community, like a sustainable agriculture ordinance that, within its text, bans agribusiness corporations from farming, but also does a bunch of other things within the text. It's about upping the ante. I mean, in these democracy schools that we teach, we use a phrase, and it's controversial to some, but it's not controversial to me anymore because I believe it, which is we live in a corporate state. We live in a corporate state where our institutions, whether they be the courts, the legislature, the executive, or other institutions that operate subordinate to them, are not our own, that they are used against us by a small minority of people who are using them to control what happens within our communities. I don't know about you, but I was taught that democracy was about something different than that. I was taught that democracy, what people bled and died for, Lexington and Concord and all those places, to give birth to the Declaration of Independence and this place, was about something else. It's about community majorities making those decisions, not corporate minorities. Something fascinating started to happen in Pennsylvania after we began adopting those agribusiness and sludge ordinances, which was this. The questions that people started asking were no longer about sludge, were no longer about factory farms, but were about rights and how it was possible that corporations had more rights than the communities in which they operate, which is what the structure of law is today. Corporations, a lot of people don't know this, but corporations have constitutional rights under the law today. Corporations are persons under the law. It may sound strange. I've gone through the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I don't see the word corporation anywhere in those documents, right? I've looked pretty closely, but not there. But in the late 1800s, the federal courts declared that corporations were persons under the law. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means all those Bill of Rights protections that you and I have, you know, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Seventh Amendment, Ninth Amendment, 14th Amendment, all the really big ones, right? That corporations today are persons entitled to the same constitutional rights and protections as you, right? It's not Pandora's box of legal secrets either. It's well-settled law. It's taught in every law school. Corporations are persons. How do they use those rights? They use them to knock the crap out of our communities, to override laws that we pass within our communities on certain issues. That's how those corporate constitutional rights are used. Yes?
I agree with you on all that, but corporations as persons also gives us the right to sue a corporation, the same way we would sue another person.
Actually not. That's not true. Corporations as constitutional rights are used as swords against communities. Our right to sue corporations is actually written into the corporation's codes of our state legislatures. That's something different. That's not constitutionally based. So for
not constitutionally based, but they're considered a person, and so they can be named as a defendant in a lawsuit.
No, that's not true. It doesn't accord to their status as a person. It's simply that when the state charters a corporation, there are certain powers given to it through the corporation's code that say to sue or to be sued. It does not flow from their status as a person. It's actually an enforcement status. Well, it's true. I mean, not to harp on it, but that's the way it is. It's two separate things. You have the constitutional rights structure, which is about persons having constitutional rights. And then there's a corporation's code, which says corporations can sue or be sued. And it's that provision that gives you the power to sue the corporation. It's not about the corporate persons. That's a very, very important point. In Pennsylvania, what started to happen was people didn't focus anymore on the single issue. The question wasn't about parts per million or water pollution or odor pollution or single issues. It began about corporations. People started talking about corporate power and corporate rights being more than the rights in their communities. And something interesting started to happen next, which was we were asked by a group of township officials and township governments to draft a local law that stripped corporations of constitutional rights and powers at the municipal level, at the township level. Now, to us, that signaled something important was happening in Pennsylvania, which was local government elected officials were saying to themselves, we take an oath when we get elected to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of this community. We cannot and have been rendered helpless to protect the health, safety, and welfare of citizens of this community if corporations have the rights to nullify what we pass within our municipality to carry out the protection of that health, safety, and welfare. It showed us that people in Pennsylvania were beginning to think beyond the single issue work, beyond the corporate farming, corporate sludge work, and were thinking about restoring their rights to make decisions about what their communities look like in 20, 40, or 60 years, as against the rights asserted by the corporations to override those rights in their communities. This ordinance is a fascinating ordinance. It's in the vein of the disobedience that this country started out with as the Declaration of Independence. And essentially it says corporations operating or doing business within these communities will not have constitutional powers and rights within those communities. It's pretty big stuff. First community in Clarion County, about 2 hours north of Pittsburgh, adopted the law and became the first municipality in the United States to pass a binding local law stripping corporations of constitutional rights at the local level. Five other municipalities have followed across Pennsylvania. Just recently in New Hampshire, a little town called Barnstead, through a town meeting of 124-1, adopted an ordinance that bans corporations from withdrawing water from their aquifer. They were faced with a plan by Nestle Corporation to withdraw 300,000 gallons of water per week to ship to Europe as part of a water bottling operation. And the folks in Barnstead, instead of screwing around with a regulatory structure in which they would decree how much water could be pulled out of the aquifer per day or per week, instead banned the corporations from withdrawing water from the aquifer in the first place. In addition to stripping corporations of constitutional rights within that framework and structure of the ordinance. In Pennsylvania, we've moved beyond ordinances into something called home rule. In terms of upping the ante in this little chess game that's developed not only in Pennsylvania but in some other places, that home rule provisions in Pennsylvania allow communities to begin writing their own constitutions at the local level. Constitutions that rewrite their municipal charters to, in essence, constitutionalize what has begun as ordinances within those communities, to put those ordinances on a higher level in a constitutional structure, making it harder to challenge them than as standalone ordinances within the municipality. That's beginning to happen in a couple different communities in Pennsylvania. All to say that the work that started in Pennsylvania is now spreading. We used to get phone calls 4 years ago from communities in Montana and California and Washington State and Alaska and Illinois and Indiana and up and down the East Coast who would say, we've heard what's happening in Pennsylvania with this work. We've heard this, and we want to replicate it where we are. Those phone calls began taking up about 20 hours a week in our office. I remember getting really pissed off, and somebody from Montana called in, and he said, I want to know what's going on, and I want you to talk to me. And I said, that's great, but if you guys would just stop calling in, we could get a lot more done here in Pennsylvania. Instead of having to talk about the line, he said, well, instead of getting pissy with me, why don't you set up a school where people can come and learn what's happening in Pennsylvania, maybe take pieces of it back to their communities and replicate some of this organizing? We said, do you think anybody will come? And he said, I don't know. Why don't you try? And so we set up the first democracy school at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. It was back in 2003. 5 people showed up, 3 people from out of state, 2 people from Pennsylvania. And the democracy schools have now grown. We've taught 137 of them, the most recent one in Stafford. They've graduated 1,900 people. And those 1,900 graduates are now going back to their communities and starting to build different types of campaigns. Those schools have now been built in 23 states as well. We have trained lecturers who then go out to teach these schools. And in New York, we just taught our sixth one here in New York. Jack and Valerie are 2 of the folks that are coordinating Democracy New York in putting these democracy schools together. So I'm going to end there because I've talked for quite a while. Just to give you the whole Pennsylvania story, but just to end with this. When we come in to do community presentations, or even to do the democracy schools, which are 3-day intensive training sessions about looking at the last 150 years that put us in the position that we're in right now, and trying to figure out how to dismantle all those layers, instead of just being the chickens running around with their heads cut off, testifying at public hearings where the microphones aren't even connected, right? Because nobody's listening. That it means moving in a more fundamental way. Right? That even at the democracy schools, we say something to folks. And what we say to them is, we're not here to sell anything to you. Right? It would be great if folks picked this up in New York, which hasn't happened yet. If folks picked this up in New York, it's protective layers for folks in Pennsylvania, because after all, if it only happens in one state or one place or a couple states or a couple places, it's going to get crushed. Right? But we're not here to sell anything to people. We're here to tell a story about what's happening in Pennsylvania. If you see something useful within that material, we're here to help you. As a nonprofit law firm, we can't charge legal fees. Right? We're prohibited under the law from charging legal fees. Normally, a lawyer would come in to a situation and say, hey, we can win this permit appeal. Just raise $20,000 for us. Right? And then the community group becomes the fundraiser for the lawyer, and the lawyer makes strategic and tactical decisions, all the meanwhile stuck in a regulatory framework. Right? Which leads nowhere. Right? We're not here to sell anything. I want to be clear about that right off the bat. We're here to assist. If you see something in this organizing that might be worthwhile to you in issues that you're dealing with up here, whether it's sludge, whether it's water withdrawal, whether it's something else. And that's what we're here tonight to do, as well as Jack and Valerie to talk about Democracy New York and the democracy schools that are being hosted in New York State. So, questions?
You're listening to Tom Lindsay of CellDef, speaking about the new democracy movement that's challenging corporate rights in the name of people and planet. We'll continue with questions and answers and hear from local organizers of Democracy New York, Jack Ossent and Valerie Gardner, working to build the movement here. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.